This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Slate's Audiobook Club, a monthly bit of book chat where today we're talking about Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, a widely acclaimed and Booker Prize-winning novel. When I say we, I include Jacob Weisberg, the chairman of the Slate Group. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Troy.
And we have here John Swansburg, Slate's culture editor.
Great to be here.
That makes me Troy Patterson. I write about television and such for this magazine, but right now I'm also going to read you an ad, and that is an ad for Audible.com, our beloved sponsor, which offers more than 50,000 downloadable audiobooks. If you sign up for a one-book-a-month subscription to Audible through our URL, you'll get a credit good for one free book, yours to keep, even if you cancel your subscription. The address there is www.audiblepodcast.com/slate, and I'm sure that there's no doubt that you can pick up A Wolf Hall there.
And it's very good. I don't know the name of the reader, but I read it sort of toggling between the printed text and listening to the Audible version, as I am wont to do recently with a lot of books. And it's a good way to do it.
And how did that experience affect your understanding of Wolf Hall here?
I think it helped. For some reason, it helps, partly because the Audible, the reading aloud, slows you down. And I don't mean to jump the gun a little bit, but this is sort of a hard book in a lot of ways to get oriented in. And just slowing down helps a lot when you're trying to get a grip on the 5-page cast of characters.
Right.
Right. All right. So what we have here, Wolf Hall is about Henry VIII and one or two of his 6 wives. We're spending time primarily, the protagonist is Thomas Cromwell, the first Earl of Essex, and Henry's chief minister in the 1530s. So as such, this is a fiction that follows in the tradition of Shakespeare's Henry VIII and Robert Bolt's Man for All Seasons and Richard Burton's Anne of a Thousand Days and Showtime's The Tudors. And so, John, where do you how do you think this book fits into that tradition?
Well, the most obvious thing, a difference, I think, is just the way that it obviously is the way it treats Thomas Cromwell. Cromwell is very much the hero of this book, and traditionally he's been quite the opposite. He's been portrayed as a villain. I'm not up on Showtime, but I know in A Man for All Seasons, he is very much a nemesis of Thomas More and is portrayed as quite a bad guy to spend time with. Whereas here, he's quite an amazing hero. I personally fell in love with him reading this book or reading this version of him, which is, I don't know his history all that well, but in just doing some reading around the book, it sounds like Mantel has sort of reinvented him somewhat ahistorically, but he's really a character you want to spend time with, and he's quite great. I don't know if you guys also felt that way, but.
Well, I was sort of thinking of Cromwell as Henry VIII's Rahm Emanuel, you know?
Yeah.
And, I guess I don't know this history very well, but generally Cromwell is this very Machiavellian henchman to Henry VIII, who was sort of the procurer of his wives, and fairly cutthroat character. But in Hilary Mantel's version, to the extent he is a cutthroat character, and she clearly soft pedals that a lot,
yeah,
making more the bad guy. But he's doing it in the service of a larger cause, which is, surprisingly, both sort of Britain's independence and, modernization, but also this kind of humanism.
Mm-hmm.
He identifies with the heretics to some extent. He thinks they should be free to read the Bible in English. He doesn't like the totalitarianism of Thomas More's English Catholicism. And he sort of she hints at him doing bad stuff, including killing someone in the mysteries of the past.
Right.
But for a good reason.
Right.
So both of you are inclined to view him unambiguously as a hero, then?
As he's portrayed here, yeah, I think so. Almost to the point where I feel like if the book has a flaw, it's that he's too easy to like. I mean, he loves little dogs. He takes in orphans. Even when he's acting at his most Machiavellian, you have this sense that he's doing it for a larger purpose. As Jake mentioned, I don't know in the end if it's too much, but I felt like if there was a problem with the book, it was that I wasn't challenged enough into thinking that, oh, well, maybe what he's doing isn't something I should admire.
Well, the real contrast is with Thomas More, and this is great opposition between them. When I finished the book, I went immediately into John's office, which is next to mine. I read it over the Christmas holidays and was enthusing about it. But amazingly, these two famous portraits by Hans Holbein of Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell are in New York City at the Frick Gallery. I think it's amazing that these paintings are in New York. It would be like if, the sort of Gilbert Stuart portraits of George Washington were in the National Gallery in London. Well, maybe there is one in the National Gallery of London. He did a lot of one, but there was only one copy of each of
right.
them. But there's this great historical opposition, and Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, which you referred to at the beginning, is the kind of classic, the kind of cliché portrayal of More as this hero of conscience and standing up to Henry VIII because he didn't think what he was doing was right and, getting executed in favor of his beliefs. And Cromwell is the classic villain in that. And this novel totally reverses that to an extent that is, wonderful and surprising, but probably a little implausible. The negative portrayal of More is not implausible.
Right.
The idea that he's, if Cromwell's the Rahm Emanuel, More is the Dick Cheney. he's tortures people. He thinks that nothing is too bad for the enemies of the true religion of Catholic theology, and he has women burned at the stake and enjoys it, has prisoners in his house. I think that all rang very true. What didn't ring true is, to me, a little bit, although I'm not sure it's a flaw in the novel, but just if you asked me to guess where does this novel depart from the truth, the idea that Cromwell wouldn't do any of those things, that he did have this humanistic side and that he was repelled by More's methods as opposed to probably just being a political enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, I found it. I suppose I'll go ahead and agree with you that he is the hero here, but there's a sense that in rooting for him, it's kind of like rooting for Michael Corleone in The Godfather.
Right.
And it's one thing that the novelist does with great skill is encouraging your sympathy for this figure. It helps. It's a bit of a cheat, maybe, that the first chapter is we're witnessing this brutal beating that his father, a blacksmith in Putney, is delivering to him as a youth. And so that sort of encourages some sympathy before we leap ahead and get his career going. And it sort of like slowly emerges that, that this figure who might be kind of like a paper pusher or a middle manager, first as Cardinal Wolsey's right hand, there's this creeping sense of his, the pleasure he takes in sort of the exercise of power in itself. And there's a kind of sort of like steady peeling away of, how to put it, it's sort of peeling away a gradual revelation of his nature, his nature as a political animal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would point out there are an awful lot of snakes in this book, both literally and sort of used as metaphors.
Yeah, there's lots of bags of snakes.
Yeah.
Someone has a great line about how getting married is a bad idea because it's like reaching into a bag where there are, six snakes and one eel and you're trying to grab the eel.
Yeah.
That was a nice metaphor.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Troy. I mean, I found him a very sympathetic as well as a compelling character. But the question is, he is pursuing power. He's amassing wealth and power himself. So why are you rooting for him? As with Michael Corleone or a lot of characters who do bad things, I think part of what you admire about them is their skill. And he is this man of parts who has this tremendous range of skills. There's one passage in the book, which I will not find right now, but it says he knew how to train a falcon, to break up a fight, to rig a jury, and there's several other things. But he's had this he's this incredible worldly figure who's lived in Antwerp, lived in Florence, knows how the world works in a way that's really beyond the understanding that his contemporaries in Britain have. And when he says he knows how to fix a jury, you know, that's not intrinsically a good thing. Although if he's fixing a jury to, you know, help heretics escape execution, maybe it is. But you just admire his kind of universal skillfulness. He's a sort of Odysseus-like figure, and mm-hmm. he knows where the levers are and how to pull the strings.
Right.
And there's another sort of metaphor that runs through the book. I think it's actually the title of one of the chapters called "Arrange Your Face." And one of the things that, you know, he has this he keeps saying to himself throughout the book. You know, he's talking about arranging his face to, given what the situation is, knowing sort of who his interlocutor is, knowing the situation, knowing whether to be an enforcer, knowing whether to win sort of more bees with honey, and sort of taking all those skills that you mentioned. And there's a element of fun in watching him approach these very disparate situations and always kind of coming out on top, whether he's dealing with Catherine, Henry's first wife, trying to make her come around to the king's position, or whether he's dealing with the Duke of Norfolk, a kind of blustery nobleman who sort of looks down his nose at Thomas Cromwell, in part because he's the son of a poor son of a blacksmith. It doesn't matter what the situation is; he knows how to handle it, and that's part of the pleasure. I think it's the end that he's seeking in all those cases is not always one that you necessarily think is a good one, but there is real pleasure in watching him sort of arrange his face for the occasion and sort of carry the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Two points I would make about what Jacob was saying before and about Cromwell's attractions, about his being a man with a vast array of skills. For one thing, that sort of array of talents and his sort of, he's a little bit too dry and even-tempered to call it a lust for power, but fixation on it has to do with his sort of class background, right? Which a constant theme in the book as well, it should be, with all these people who are born to the merchant class or the aristocrats, sort of sneering at this sort of gutter-born, sort of self-made person. And meaningfully, like, one of the rumors that goes around court about him is that his father is a butcher rather than a blacksmith.
Right.
That's a good mistake. And then there's also, you know, about his – there's something of sort of the dark magician to a man who can sort of be both as sort of wily and conniving as Cromwell was, and in this complicated way. I think one of the ways the book gets its juice is it's sort of half sunk in, like, myth, and there's sort of, like, this fog of mystery and magic hanging on it. I guess one early chapter is called, like, An Occult History of Britain. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are just, like, little atmospheric ways that she gives the sense that, you know, these are people who, you know, think about hell and demons and, you know, sort of spirits in a way that's much more palpable. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, Cromwell cultivates an air of mystery about himself. You know, he likes people to know sort of that he killed somebody in Italy, and you know, but he doesn't clear anything up. And also the way the story is told, very interesting. It's narrated in the present tense, and you're inside Cromwell's head, but he is seldom referred to by his name. He's usually referred to by third-person pronoun as he. So it's a little bit disorienting, and that also kind of creates this kind of feeling of mystery and not really knowing where you are in relation to him. And another sort of curiosity is that the language used to narrate the story is not archaic. You know, there's no kind of Shakespearean verbiage. There is in quotations from the characters, but the author uses this sort of fairly contemporary diction to tell the story. So you're a little bit, you know, it's not historicized in this way that's supposed to be totally authentic.
Right. Mantell seems – it's interesting. She doesn't really tell us anything about his backstory either. I mean, in some – we get, as Troy mentioned, that sort of very vivid opening vignette where he's getting kicked around, kicked in the face by his father. And we get a little bit of snippets of him kind of proceeding from his kind of gutter upbringing to Europe. But then Europe is kind of a blank page. There are allusions to he fought for the French as sort of, I guess, a mercenary. He's a banker in Italy and Antwerp. But we don't really know – what happened there. So we're sort of left to kind of, you know, wonder as well. That sort of contrasts with the great detail that we witness the sort of great historic events, and, you know, that are part of what the book is covering. You know, we're in the bedroom with Anne Boleyn when, you know, she's with child. We're privy to, the king's asides when he's, you know, taking archery lessons. You know, we're right there. And that's one of the great pleasures of the book as well. But, you know, it does make it stand out that we don't really... We're sort of left to mythologize Cromwell's past a little bit as well.
These great little glimpses of description. I think at one point he describes Henry VIII with these ruby rings on his fingers as having bubbles of blood.
Yeah.
You know, and I think another reason, sort of getting back to Troy's question, why you admire this character and identify with him is he's a early Renaissance man at the end of the Middle Ages. So, you know, the England where he shows up is this very medieval place. You know, the monasteries are still there. People are eating the wormy bread. You know, it's just this kind of, you know, vision of kind of very primitive, unmodern society. And because he's this worldly character and has been to these places like Antwerp and Florence where the Renaissance has already gotten underway and is in touch with what's happening in ideas and art and food. And, you know, Hans Holbein is his friend.
Right.
And these great little other bits, you know, Hans Holbein is staying at his house and he's complaining about how he's got to finish this painting of the French ambassador. And of course, that's Holbein's most famous picture, the
right.
Ambassadors, you know, which is I think it's in the National Gallery. But he's not a man out of time. I mean, this is the real transition that happened, and the things that Cromwell helped facilitate were essential to it.
Right. He's not a man out of time, but he's sort of a man out of time in Britain a little bit, or in England. He's been exposed to those ideas, but a lot of his contemporaries in England haven't. And so, again, when you're sort of sitting back and thinking about why you root for him, I think part of the reason is you understand that he has sort of more enlightened ideas about a lot of these things. And he wants to grab power, but I think he also wants to make England a power. He wants it to be able to compete on a global stage in a way that it hasn't. He has a line at one point. I think he thinks that Wolsey started that process. You know, he says at some point, you know, before Wolsey, England was just a cold island, you know, off the coast that didn't have any power and was really backwards. And I think he sees his mission not just to grab power for himself, but also to make England a more modern place. And one of the interesting ideas that I think he brings as well, and from his experience in Italy, is the idea of the importance of money and. A lot of the people that he encounters in King Henry's court are obsessed with nobility and lineage, and he sort of understands that the way the world is going to work in the future has to do with who controls the money, and a lot of that control is in Europe. It's not in England, and the king's ability to wage war, the nobility's ability to sort of stay in their seats, all has to do with who has the debts, who can call in the chits, and his connections to the continent. You know, that's part of his power.
Check.
and the English nobility is shown to be really backward,
right?
Because they don't understand any of this,
right?
They think power is still based on family and title and royal estates and, you know, royal patents and all of that kind of thing.
Right.
And they're sort of, you know, they're kind of trading in the wrong currency.
Right. There's a great scene sort of toward the end of the book where Harry Percy, who's, I think, the Lord of Northumberland, he's, a noble whose job it is to kind of keep the Scots at bay in the north of England. He thinks that as a youth, Anne Boleyn has pledged herself to him and that they had some sort of clandestine marriage that would, of course, mess up Henry VIII's plans to marry Anne. And at one point, he starts making noise about how, Anne and I had this, you know, this secret compact. And there's a great scene where Cromwell just sort of sits him down and says, "You cannot do this. And Harry Percy's first response is, "Who are you? You're some son of a blacksmith. You can't tell me what to do. I'm a lord." And he says, "Look, you may be a lord, but I hold the purse strings. I can bankrupt you tomorrow. I can get all the people you owe money to say pay them back immediately. I have the king's ear as a result, and you have to do what I say." And it's just great kind of shift in the balance of power that this blacksmith's son, it's not just because he has Henry's ear, it's because, you know, he sort of knows the way the world works now, and he can tell these old entitled nobles what to do.
Yeah. You know, the fact that these intrigues are the sort of this power of the book, it makes me wonder if I can see this catching on with, like, Hollywood agents and hip-hop crews, like, you know, the way that The Art of War would.
Right.
And I also want to say, I've been sitting here, like, flipping through, like, trying to do three things at once, flipping through this 530-page book to find some succinct examples of how funny this guy is. Part of his appeal is rape your wit, and that's another indication of what Hilary Mantel's doing really superbly here. What I don't know if she's doing superbly, somehow this book is very engaging, I find, but kind of sort of slow going. In miniature, there's a lot of great stuff to absorb, but it doesn't really flow. And I think it's partly of necessity that it's got to be more sort of outlined than plotted, right? Sort of,
right.
You know, tellingly, a lot of chapters begin by just situating us in terms of date. So we feel like we're, in my experience of reading, you're just kind of ticking along down the road as opposed to sort of feeling forces come into conflict. You're sort of, how to put it?
You're watching
the conflict unfold rather than build.
Yeah, yeah, read for kind of. I was sort of wondering that because it's not usual that a book that's sort of hard to read is as enjoyable and immersive as this is. And I'm not sure. I think partly she was intentionally disorienting you, you know, with some of the devices I was describing earlier, where she refers to him, you know, in the third person. And, you know, it's meant to be some work for the author. And it's work that you have to keep kind of going back to the cast of characters at the beginning and the genealogical chart. And, you know, people have the same names. Everyone's called Thomas. Thomas or Henry. And you have to kind of keep going back and figuring out who people are. And in a lesser book, I think that would be more annoying. But somehow, I felt this was sort of so well told that in a way you were willing to do the work and you didn't mind doing the work.
Yeah, I agree with that. I kept wondering what the experience would be to read this as if I'd grown up as an Englishman, mm-hmm. you know, where the history was just sort of more part of you know, my upbringing and my schooling. That might have helped a little bit with the vast cast of characters and all the Thomases. But I still think even so, it would have been a little tricky. And I definitely noticed the same thing you did, Troy, that it felt like some of the chapters or some of the sections within the chapters, they opened with these sort of, you know, it felt like a dateline. It's, you know, 1527 in Putney, and it almost gave this feeling of like that Hilary Mantel had mapped out a timeline. In some cases, just started, you know, where this is the place where I know we want to advance the plot. I want to focus in, and sort of gone from there. And there were some parts of the story that I found more engaging than others. I mean, whenever the plot turned to Henry's court, I was really engaged. His repartee with Cromwell's repartee with the king, and also with Anne, I felt they were both very worthy sparring partners, and both Anne and the king are fully realized characters and very interesting characters at that.
So Mary Boleyn's a lot of fun too.
Mary Boleyn is fantastic, yes. And she her relationship with Cromwell is really great. They're sort of almost have an affair on more than one occasion.
She sort of propositions him.
She propositions him in Calais once, right? And then and then I was thinking up one other point. And at one point, she's sort of proposed as a match for Cromwell's son, or I guess it's technically his nephew, Richard. But yeah, she's like she's very racy, and she kind of is a great character. When she comes in, you kind of always get the straight talk about what's really happening in the sort of Boleyn circle, and she can be somewhat bawdy.
She kind of reminds me of one of the, she's like a third Sternwood daughter from The Big Sleep, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
He has a lot of respect for women. Mm-hmm. You know, he educates his daughter. He's kind of the figure he most loves is his daughter who dies in the plague, which is a very kind of sad and moving part of the book. But he's teaching his daughter Greek, and he's very proud of how good she is at it. And he's educating her the way people didn't usually educate girls. And then one other person who does, interestingly, is Thomas More, who he's sort of competitive with. But More likes these docile, dull women for his wives. And is married to one. She dies. He marries another one. You know, again, Cromwell has this wife who's kind of an intellectual equal, who mm-hmm. also... Well, not to give too much away, but I figure it's a historical novel, right? So
yeah.
You're not supposed to not know, but anyway, yeah. Plague's not so good to her either.
And also, actually, there's one moment that is I found very powerful, although it kind of an interesting moment. I wonder what you guys make of it. But there's this one flashback that he has is to the killing of a heretic. I guess she's technically called a lawler. I think she denies the transubstantiation. And he sort of wanders away from home when he's a young boy. I think he's sort of afraid his dad's going to beat him up, which he's wise to be afraid. And he sort of witnesses the sort of brutal killing by burning of this heretic.
It's an intense scene.
It's a very intense scene.
He saw it when he was a boy, so you see it through this kind of his remembered child's eyes.
Wait, can you find it? Do you want to read it?
Yeah, let me see if I can find it. So this is on page 290. And as we've said, this is the young Thomas Cromwell. He's wandered from home, and he comes across this woman who's about to be burned, and this is Mantle. The stake was on top of a pile of stones, and some gentlemen came, and priests, bishops perhaps, he did not know. They called out to the lawler to put off her heresies. He was close enough to see her lips moving, but he could not hear what she said. What if she changes her mind now? Will they let her go? Not they, the woman chuckled. Look, she is calling on Satan to help her. The gentleman withdrew. The officers banked up wood and bales of straw around the lawler. The woman tapped her on the shoulder. Let's hope it's damp, eh? This is a good view. Last time I was at the back. The rain had stopped. The sun broke through. When the executioner came with a torch, it was pale in the sunshine, barely more than a slick movement, like the movement of eels in a bag. The monks were chanting and holding up a cross to the lawler, and it was only when they skipped backward at the first billow of smoke that the crowd knew the fire was set. It goes on from there, describing some details, the death of this woman, which is pretty awful. And it struck me as interesting that this was a woman that he saw burned at the stake. It seemed like a not accidental choice. And I thought this was an interesting scene because it kind of gives some backstory to Cromwell's ambivalent, at best, understanding or feelings towards religion. It was something we touched on earlier, that he seems throughout the book to dislike people of too great religious fervor, people who are unwilling to make any compromise because of their feelings. I mean, that's one of the things that comes up with Moore and also with Tyndale, who's an exile and a translator of the Bible. He has a line at one point about how he can't understand these religious men who aren't willing to make some small sacrifice in their belief to advance a cause.
Right.
And that's obviously his modus operandi is his beliefs are malleable to suit the occasion, and I think in some way he admires this woman for not changing her belief, but he sees the result of what happens, and he also sees the result of these fanatical religious people who are willing to commit this kind of awful crime against this woman.
I mean, this incredible cruelty and public bloodlust and sadism and also masochism in the case of Thomas More, who wears a hair shirt, is sort of is the backdrop to this whole story. And the title of the book is Wolf Hall, which refers specifically to the place where Jane Seymour's family lives. It doesn't figure that much in the book. It's sort of, it becomes important, I think, in the period after this, because Jane Seymour is Henry VIII's next wife.
Right.
Takes place off stage. But, you know, there's the there's a famous Latin expression, which
homo homini lupus?
Yes.
Yes, very good. Which translates as man as a wolf to his fellow man. I was just sort of thinking, that popped in my head reading that, because on every page there's, you know, this just horrific religiously based violence. And I think in the sort of final analysis, Cromwell is a hero because he represents less of that and then move away from that.
Right. There's a great scene where I think it's the first time that Cromwell goes to meet Moore. And he's I think it's Wolsey who's told him that he should, you know, you should always wonder about what people wear under their clothes. And he's thinking about Thomas More's hair shirt, and sort of clothes are kind of a great theme in this book. Because one of his experiences in Europe is kind of like getting to know different fabrics, and he's always sort of touching, Cromwell's always touching fabrics to find out sort of their quality and worth. And he finds himself kind of musing about how that hair shirt gets made. You know, is it made by monks who sort of are thinking to themselves, you know, how best can I craft a shirt to create these sores that are going to weep and make someone, you know, feel awful, or is it done by someone who doesn't quite realize what the purpose of the shirt is? I kind of love that he sort of muses on things like that.
Well, actually, let me read that that hair shirt paragraph, which is on it's on page 72. I put a big check mark by it and made a note that it kind of sounded a little bit like Elizabeth Bishop to me in a way. So here we are. Under his clothes, it is well known, Moore wears a jerkin of horsehair. He beats himself with a small scourge of the type used by some religious orders. What lodges in his mind, Thomas Cromwell's, is that somebody makes these instruments of daily torture. Someone combs the horsehair into coarse tufts, knots them, and chops the blunt ends, knowing that their purpose is to snap off under the skin and irritate it into weeping sores. Is it monks who make them, nodding and snipping in a fury of righteousness, chuckling at the thought of the pain they will cause to persons unknown? Are simple villagers paid, how, by the dozen, for making flails with waxed knots? Does it keep farm workers busy during the slow winter months? When the money for their honest labor is put into their hands, do the makers think of the hands that will pick up the product? Which is really just lovely, and it's got a nice rhythm. And it also points toward another thing that makes the book very likable, is that it's a historical novel, but not it avoids the pitfalls of being like a costume drama.
I thought you liked the Tudors.
That's you know, pulp has its own place, but this novel qualifies as, it's too dry to be to satisfy as pulp.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I was thinking about that, Troy. Is, you know, what makes a good historical novel? I mean, first of all, do you like historical novels? Do either of you, is that a sort of category that you kind of go out of your way either to read or to avoid reading?
I don't think I've gone out of my way to avoid reading them, but I haven't read that many. I mean, I think War and Peace might be the last historical novel I read, and that was some time ago. So this was, but this, you know, reading a book of this quality made me think, well, maybe I should read more of them because I really did. I think not many are executed as well as this, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think it would be really short-sighted to dismiss historical novels out of hand, just sort of books about historical personages from the past, but the sad fact is that so many of them, or at least so many of the ones that I've attempted to read, you know, always have people sort of reaching for their teacup or sort of making a big deal out of, I don't know, oiling the saddle or whatever. And, you know, this is, again, I think something that's great about how this book works, but also sort of accounts for its irregularity of pace is that this, and I think that this comes through in the passages that John and I both read, is that the attention to detail is both sort of specific, but she's tending to focus on details that are sort of out of time in a way. We don't get bogged down in the sort of cut of petticoats.
Right. She doesn't fetishize the detail, and you never get the sense that she's sort of showing off her research.
Right.
It all seems to be pertinent to what's going on, to sort of making you feel like you're there and making you understand what the characters are feeling. And also, she has a real knack for symbolism, and a lot of the detail is, I think, chosen with an eye towards what it means and how it's going to recur throughout the novel.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be sort of a two-page passage that could be, you know, in its physical details, it could be happening anywhere at any time, and then maybe it'll build to a sort of a short flight of fancy and sort of figurative speech that with a couple nice little gems of observation.
Right. Like one example that pops to mind is Cardinal Wolsey, when he falls, when eventually he's unable to get Henry what he wants, i.e. a divorce from Catherine. So Wolseley is relieved of his command as Lord Chancellor. And one of the things that he has to give back is his robe, his sort of cardinal-colored robe that he usually wears in that capacity. And again, Cromwell is sort of obsessed with these
the
with
garments,
cloth.
Yeah,
and he says, you know, at that point in history, you know, you wouldn't throw that away. It was, you know, but I guess no one else was going to wear it. But he says, you know, that's going to be cut up, and you may see a little flash of that in the petticoat of a prostitute or the sort of inside sleeve of a gentleman. And he kind of just goes on this kind of muse about, you know, where that fabric will end up. And it's kind of an interesting fact that, you know, that obviously you would recycle cloth of that quality in 1530, but also it has sort of, you know, relatively obvious metaphorical
meaning
too. Great
metaphor for what was happening to the Catholic Church and the, you know, it being broken up and the, you know, the monasteries being sold off, the money being used.
Exactly.
Used
right.
And also kind of a sly way of it's like a throwaway line that gives the novel some sweep without, you know, in an effortless seeming way.
It's a fantastic image, you know, this beautiful pink cloth, which he describes at length as an incredibly expensive cloth. And then, you know, here's how it's going to sort of end up being used. But I mean, I thought, you know, as a historical novel, I thought it was really interesting because it doesn't come out of the genre of historical fiction. I mean, the kind of, you know, the fairly hackish, you know, James Michener, Irving Stone. I don't know if you guys read any of those books growing up. I quite liked them when I was a, you know, teenager. But
yeah, I read a little Michener.
That's totally, you know, totally absorbing, huge historical narrative with big characters, and it smelled like this. And, you know, this kind of is totally different from that in a number of ways that work in its favor. One, she doesn't seem principally concerned with the big historical events. I mean, there's this big historical event at the heart of this, which is England's break with the Catholic Church and Henry VIII's divorce from his first wife. But, you know, the kind of the great moments are not all there. It's mostly the action offstage. But two other dimensions I think are really important. One is the sort of literary approach to the subject, you know, that she kind of is so concerned with sort of voice and perspective and character. But the other, and I think this is the thing that really makes this novel so brilliant, is working around the known historical facts. You know, a historical novel stops working if there's something that you know is actually impossible or didn't happen. You have these kind of obstacles like slalom skiing. You've got to get around what you know. But then to within that come up with a theory of the history and the characters that turns what's sort of accepted on its head and get away with it is just sort of a coup, you know, because, I mean, to sort of I don't know enough about the history to know where she's pushing it, but based on a few reviews I read of the book and so on, I think she's – historians think, well, maybe that's not the way it was, but there's nothing obviously wrong with it, you know, and sort of to use what we know and make you think about it in a what if differently. What if everything we assume about this period is wrong and it really was very different? That's really kind of a great concept to animate a book like this.
All right, then. So then the question then, John, is how does what did you make of the Henry VIII of this book? Is he like the man with the big mutton chop? Is he the Jonathan Rhys-Meyers you were?
I really admired the portrait of this Henry. He's a complicated character, and I imagine it's a somewhat difficult one to. To paint, you know, sometimes he is the sort of caricature that I had imagined, this kind of petulant, childish king who sort of, you know, wants his way and wants someone to sort of make his way happen for him. But at other moments, Mantell sort of stops to make you sort of admire him and sort of think about him in a different way and sort of get a sense of how smart he was and how cagey. I mean, my understanding from reading up on the history a little bit is that, you know, his older brother Arthur was going to be king. Arthur died. And so Henry was trained to go into the clergy and was given a lot of schooling and spoke a lot of languages. And Cromwell throughout the book at different moments pauses to say how much he actually admires Henry, even though he can be mercurial as kings are wont to be. And There are a couple of scenes between Cromwell's family and the king that I thought were really almost kind of poignant, where Henry brings Cromwell in, and Cromwell brings his two sons, and Henry compliments them in this really kind of magnanimous way, and it brightens the spirits of the Cromwell children. And there's a certain magnanimity of spirit about Henry, despite the fact that he's, you know, goes about lopping off the heads of wives who don't produce male issue for him.
Right.
He's not just like a two-dimensional caricature.
She goes beyond the cape on leg waving, you know, bling encrusted cliche. Part of it is Henry doesn't cut off that many people's heads in this book. We know
right.
he did later. But at the end of this book, he hasn't cut off any wives' heads, including his first wife's. And in fact, and having grown up in England, I don't know this story as well as all English school children learn it, but he spent a really long time trying to make a deal with Catherine of Aragon, his first wife, and work this out. You know, he ends up deposing Cardinal Wolsey because Wolsey, in this impossible situation, can't get the Roman Church to agree to let him divorce Catherine of Aragon. But he doesn't just do what he wants. I mean, he's aware of these, you know, sort of more than formalities he has to go through. And he's not complicated in that he has the kind of intellectual sophistication that Cromwell does. And you don't think, my God, this guy's a brilliant operator moving chess pieces. But you do sympathize with him a little bit, partly because the English nobility is such a terrifying place, and there's all this plotting going on, and there's the background of, you know, the War of the Roses and the Lenke, the Castors, and the Yorks. I always forget who's who, but you know, everyone's sort of worried it's going to kind of slide back into this civil war, and he's kind of keeping it together in his way and trying to, you know, he's not just being a petulant baby and getting his every whim.
Right, and he's smart enough to recognize how useful Cromwell is,
right.
and smart enough to recognize that Cromwell could be of great use to him, even though, you know, Wolsey goes down essentially for failing to dissolve the marriage with Catherine, and you could imagine a world in which Cromwell would have gone down with Wolsey because he was Wolsey's right-hand man, but Henry is sort of savvy enough to say, to recognize, this is someone who can help me. And I think, going back to one of the themes we talked about earlier about sort of the nobility versus Cromwell, who doesn't have any station, I think Henry is savvy enough to realize that someone with Cromwell's skills and none of Cromwell's attachments is especially useful, in the sense that if you have a Machiavellian operator who's also the Duke of Norfolk and is, you know, therefore has all these allegiances to other people in the nobility, that's more of a threat to you than some blacksmith's son who can make things happen but is obviously never going to be king.
That's a very good point.
I'm absolutely serious that Hilary Mantel should follow this book with, you know, a 36 Laws of Power, like derived from Thomas Cromwell. But in the absence of such a book, we're also to understand that a sequel to this one is maybe on the way.
I read in the Guardian that it is, that when she won the Booker Prize, I think she said around that time that she's sort of knee deep in a sequel.
Okay,
I got to tell you, I don't think it's going to have a happy ending.
Well, when this book ends, Anne Boleyn's head is still attached to the rest of her.
Though Thomas Moore's is not.
Right. And so then Jane Seymour enters the picture, who, you know, in rereading this book, I was like learning stuff that I'd already forgotten twice. And then,
yes,
so between
that
this,
is the feeling you have.
Between this jogging my memory and looking in history books, I was refreshed that, so Anne Boleyn's head comes off, and then in May of 1536, Jane Seymour enters the picture and delivers a son and dies in childbirth. And then things start going downhill for Thomas Cromwell after that, I guess. He sort of pushes for political reasons, he pushes Henry into this marriage with Anne of Cleves.
Right. And his downfall is quite swift, which is interesting. It makes you wonder kind of how you would handle that dramatically. As I understand it, Cromwell maintains the high station that we see him achieve in this book for a few more years, and then, you know, he's elevated, I think, to, was it the Earl of Essex? Is that what you mentioned at the top of the show? And then 3 months later, he's arrested, and I think and killed shortly thereafter. Right. So, and there are a couple of interesting allusions to that in this book, but you really have to kind of look for them. I think I only noticed them in going through the book a second time, where Wolsey warns Cromwell that you'll never see it coming. That he'll look up one day and Henry will be barreling down at you, sort of with his joust pointed at your head, and you won't have time to saddle up before he hits you. Which is in fact, I think, you know, what happens.
Well, it's
to Cromwell.
Yeah,
he
reminds me of The Wire a little bit.
Well, no, it's like it's like Goodfellas when when Joe Pesci gets made, telling him he's going to get made, and they kill him. This is really what happened historically to Thomas Cromwell. Is
right.
That he, upon getting his earldom, he was sort of suspicious that he'd gotten a little too high and mighty, and that's when you start looking over your shoulder.
Right. But it has an interesting effect on this book because, it's an interesting decision on Mantle's part to just pick this sort of 8-year period that is the focus of this book. It's just the rise of Cromwell. That, you know, the hints of what's to come for him are really around the edges, and there isn't some real sense of foreboding. I didn't sense one in reading this that this man is sort of headed for a comeuppance.
You leave him in kind of a good place. He's going to take his first vacation in a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's going off to Wolf Hall for his vacation, which
right.
is a little ominous.
It is a little ominous. But it's interesting that she chose to sort of tell this story and not darken it too much with intimations of his fate. So I wonder what it'll be like to read this book in the future if there is a sequel, knowing that it's a sort of a 2-part, or who knows, maybe it would be a 3-part eventually series, as opposed to just reading it as a single volume and they're not existing, sort of the completion of the Cromwell story.
I could cheat and see the other Boland girl, but I'm not going to.
Well, in the eventuality of such a sequel coming to press, perhaps you guys will join me back here for another spirited discussion.
That would be terrific.
Thank you for dropping by.
Thank you, Troy.
For Slate's Audiobook Club, I'm Troy Patterson.